Scripture passage this morning is from Malachi chapter 3. Malachi 3, verses 1 through 3. I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly, the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. A messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. But who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he will be like a refiner's fire and a launderer's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings in righteousness.
Luke 2, 4 to 5. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. On October 30 this year, 10 excited hikers left their home in the land of Pennsylvania to walk in the land of Israel and Palestine, starting in Nazareth and ending in Bethlehem, remembering the journey 2,000 years ago, which led to the Nativity of Jesus, a journey of 10 days, 100 miles. Chapter 1, Proclaiming the Peace in Nazareth, the Annunciation. Luke 1, 26 to 27, in the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary. It's perfectly fitting for our journey to begin where the original one began. Tradition says that Gabriel came to Mary when she was at the well drawing water. So there must be a well in Old Nazareth, and there is. In fact, there are several wells and several places which have proponents saying, this is the right place. So welcome to the Holy Land, a land of conflicts and contradictions, a land which intersects the divine and the profane, the glory of God and the squabbling of God's children. For convenience, we start our tour at the Greek Orthodox Church, an ancient church with lots of drawings on the walls, on all available space of walls and ceilings, and down several steps to a crypt with a spring. This is the place of the Annunciation, if you are Orthodox. And I sit amidst the paintings and meditate on the times of Jesus. Outside the church is this little structure with two channels of water. Too bad, this is the end of the dry season and both channels are dry now. But they call this Mary's Well. And perhaps, too, this is the place where the Annunciation may have taken place. Down a bustling street, we come to the Coptic Church of the Annunciation. Unfortunately, it's closed today. But the larger Catholic Church of the Annunciation is open for business, and hundreds of tourists and pilgrims are treading their way to the well in the lower level of this church. Nazareth, the town where Jesus' birth was announced and where Jesus grew up from a child to an adult. Chapter 2, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and languages. Our bus driver for the Sea of Galilee day knows only a little English, and I know no Arabic. He was told he was given a general idea of what we wanted to see, but he needed more specifics from me. And somehow or other, he got the impression that we, as a group, were from Germany. This impression got completely cemented on his brain after he asked what part of Germany we're from. And it so happens that our group of 10 Americans had been joined by Vanna, a Taiwanese woman studying medicine in Germany, and she knew a little bit of Arabic, so she answered the bus driver's question, I'm from Frankfurt. And I tried to add, but we're not all from Frankfurt or Germany. It didn't make any difference. So he has this idea that we're from Germany. And now he knows how to communicate with us. Just find another bus driver who knows German, and he'll be our translator. So we get another bus driver, and he asks me the questions in German, and I respond back in English, who responds back in Arabic, and it actually works. So our bus driver takes us to the Sea of Galilee. We visit the Church of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers there in Latin. St. Peter's restaurant on the Sea of Galilee, and a boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. But here things get real interesting. The boat operators have this tradition that they hoist the flag and play the national anthem of all of the passengers that are represented on their boat. Our dear bus driver knows this tradition, and he says that, of course, that we're from Germany. So they're bringing out this German flag. Well, someone in our group realized what was going on. He said, no, wait a minute, we're actually from America. Our bus driver had the wrong idea. So instead of red, black, and gold, we did get a red, white, and blue flag raised on our boat to the canned music of the Star-Spangled Banner. Okay, back in the van, then on the road again, rounding the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee, we got the idea to take a minute and stop at the Jordan River and wade in. Our bus driver understands our request and takes us straight to Yardanet, a major tourist spot. People from all over the world come here. Now at Yardanet, for 25 shekels, you can rent a white robe and a towel and join a group being baptized. Well, we aren't interested in the white robes, and all of us have already been baptized. We're just interested in wading into the water and getting our feet wet. It's actually cool and refreshing and wet. Coming out of the water, Laszlo had this interesting experience, and I'll let you hear it from his own words.
Hi, I'm Laszlo Medeiros. I was one of the unofficial interpreters on this trip. I had the pleasure and the interesting experience of coming to this area here, and as I was going into the water, Kent and I were there, and I was pondering how many different languages were being spoken all around the river as we're going towards the baptismal site. And one of the ones that was missing, there were lots of different plaques, and they had all sorts of different languages. One of them was missing was Hungarian. And my background is Hungarian, and my grandfather is a Lutheran minister, and he baptized me in Hungarian. So as we're coming out of the water here, suddenly I hear only Hungarian all around me. Up above here, a whole tourist group of Hungarians came. And that was really touching to me because it was a very moving experience. I'm a doctor and I try to use languages to build bridges with my patients. And it seemed to me here that like the Holy Spirit was welcoming us, building a bridge, saying, you guys are strangers in this land, but you're welcome here. This is your home too. So I came out of this experience just hearing the Hungarian language, and I felt very moved by it. So I just thought that was a very special moment for me. So I carry that as a very special part of this trip. So anyway.
Chapter 3, the first day on the trail, and we meet George. 2 days of sightseeing around Nazareth and the Sea of Galilee being ended, it's time to actually start the hike, the trek. Our Arabic-only speaking bus driver meets us again for the second time, this time to shuttle us to a checkpoint where on the other side is the West Bank, or Palestine, or Palestinian territories, where we will hike for the next 10 days. Our driver can only accompany us to the checkpoint. He is not allowed to enter or pass through. We have to get out and cross on foot. And our Palestinian guide waiting on the other side cannot come over to the Israeli side. We must go through several gates and corridors without any local guide. But we're brave and capable, and we manage the crossing without too much stress. Many people are standing around on the Palestinian side, but only one of them is looking for a group of 10 Americans and one Taiwanese. Hello, are you George? I ask. Yes, and are you Lyndon? He asks. And so we meet George, our guide for the next 10 days. George from Bethlehem, of all places. Wiry, dark-skinned, with a red backpack and a brown hat, George from Bethlehem. I wonder if he could be a descendant of the shepherds. No, not just any old shepherds, but the shepherds. You know, the ones who heard the angels and saw the child. Well, George says his ancestors are Italians who came from Sicily and settled in Bethlehem. Well, but I still think they must have intermarried with the descendants of the shepherds. George is my idea of a shepherd. George used to hunt animals and birds with a slingshot, that is, not with a gun, because Palestinians are not allowed to own guns, even for hunting. Only Israelis can own guns. One day, George decided he wanted to preserve animals rather than kill them. He has a great eye for spotting birds and animals. He sees and identifies them a long way off and points them out to us, first in real life, then in his little guidebook to the flora and fauna of Palestine. George tells us how the thunder brings out a certain kind of edible snail that the people of Palestine gather and eat. George is a guide, a lover of birds and animals, a man of several languages, including Arabic, English, Italian, and Hebrew. His knowledge of Hebrew is most surprising, but it comes in handy one day to calm an irate settler who thought our group had strayed too close to his settlement. Chapter 4, Zababda, a Christian village, and Farah, a refugee camp. If anyone in our group didn't know olive trees before, they sure do by now. We're hiking up hills and down hills, almost always through olive groves. The olive harvest has just ended in these parts, but there are still a few trees being picked. Olive harvest traditionally starts right after the first rain, which washes the dust off the olives. The processes of picking, sorting, separating the chaff, crushing for oil are all very labor-intensive, and donkeys get involved too. George tells us that olive farming is a good income. It's getting dark when our first hiking day reaches Zababda. Lodging tonight is a homestay, the first of several for our 10 days on the trail. We are staying in Zababda, unusual in these parts for the fact that the majority of its inhabitants are Christians. Ruthie and I stay in the home of Hanan. A woman about our own age, whose husband died a few years ago. She is surrounded by her adult children and their spouses and their children. Most of them have connections with relatives who immigrated to the U.S. I wonder if this whole family will one day be scattered across the U.S. Generally, the Christians in Palestine have connections to the outside world and therefore the option of immigration. The next night, after walking through rocks and olive groves again, we arrive at Farah. Lodging here is another homestay, and our host is Nidal. Nidal and his family live in this refugee camp, where all are Muslim. Nidal's wife has a wonderful meal cooked for us, but she never shows her face, and we never learn her name. This refugee camp is not what one would have expected. There are no tents. This camp has been here for 70 years. And the dwellings are permanent structures owned by the United Nations. Some families still have the keys to the homes they left behind during the 1948 catastrophe, expecting to return home in a few months, but they are still in this refugee camp 70 years later. Chapter 5, Nablus, Shechem, Sychar, and the church at Jacob's Well. There is no town today called Shechem. Shechem is often named in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. But the city of Shechem still exists. Now it just goes by the name Nablus. It's the second largest city in the West Bank after Hebron. Nablus is the same as Shechem, which is the same as Sychar. John 4, 1 through 7. Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near a plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" Did you notice how specific the scripture is in stating where this meeting between Jesus and the Samaritan woman took place? At Jacob's well. In our times, a Greek Orthodox church and convent are built over top Jacob's well in Nablus. Nablus is a noisy, grimy, bustling city, but when you enter the grounds of the Jacob's Well Church, you are in holy space. Green, clean, and serene are the grounds. And inside the church, light, bright colors, brilliant artwork depicting practically every story in the Bible, plus all the saints designated by the Orthodox Church. Here, the monks are Greek, and the flag is Greek. It's a little outpost of Greece. In 1979, a group of Israeli settlers decided that the Greek Christians had controlled this site long enough, and it was time to make it Jewish. They swarmed down the hill from their settlement at night and demanded to be left in. The old monk, Philomenos, said, "Anyone coming in peace may enter, but otherwise the gate is closed, and I am going inside the church now to pray." The next day, the body of Philomenos was found dead, murdered in the church, in the crypt, right beside Jacob's well. It took an international outcry to pressure the Israeli government to remove the settlers and return control of Jacob's Well Church to the Greek Orthodox. Philomenos has been declared a saint, and his relics are in this box in the church. And here are three travelers beside Jacob's well. Chapter 6, The Welcoming Children of Noisy Village. Our hike leaves Nablus and heads toward Jericho. In between, we pass through several villages. The children in these villages like to see hikers come through. So when the first kid sees us, a cry goes out and a whole gang of kids comes running. "Hello, how are you? Welcome. What's up?" are among the many greetings. "Where are you from? You are welcome here." Same message from the adults. "Welcome, we love you." The boys on bicycles follow us, then lead us, then ride beside us. When we stop at a little food store and George goes inside to buy our lunch, the bicycle boys have to liven things up a little. So popping wheelies is the game. And when they see me raise my camera, then they really ham it up. Chapter 7, Proclaiming Peace on the Jericho Road.
There's a story in the Bible that Jesus told, a story that I figure pretty much everyone in this room is familiar with. And not only church folk, but I think an awful lot of other people, even ones that have never cracked open a Bible, know and understand the main part of the story. It's found in the 10th chapter of Luke, and it starts like this. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. We all know this story, the parable of the Good Samaritan. We visited quite a few places in Israel and Palestine with religious significance, places we hear about in the Bible. Some of the places, they really don't know where it actually was, like Mary's well. Others, they know exactly, like Jacob's well. And the Good Samaritan parable is another one of them. We can't know exactly where on the road to Jericho the robbery took place, but we can be sure it happened on the road that we hiked. Because back in the days of Jesus, that was the only likely road that you took from Jerusalem to Jericho, and we hiked it. Although we were coming up from Jericho to Jerusalem, not going down. A lot of the road the biblical traveler would have walked runs through a wadi, that's a dry riverbed, the Wadi Gelt. It's really not much more than a path. And in some parts, it's hardly even that. It's easy to imagine in Jesus' day, at being a place you might be attacked and robbed by a gang of robbers who are probably lying in wait in one of these many caves up on the cliffside. No, these aren't thieves we encounter, just some weary travelers taking a rest. As I was hiking along, I was thinking of the Good Samaritan story and what Jesus teaches us in his telling. Jesus taught us that the two greatest commandments are love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. I think if some way, somehow, if many people in the world were to truly live it, and we're called to be an example of that, then the world would be a much more peaceful place. If Jesus were to tell the Good Samaritan story today, I think he would have a whole bunch of priest and Levite examples, hopefully not from us, from how we don't treat our neighbors as ourselves. In the context of the current Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Jesus probably wouldn't use a Samaritan. It would be the parable of the good Palestinian, because the Palestinians are who many current Jews really don't like. Now, these days, the road or path to Jericho is safe. There are no robbers hiding in caves ready to pounce and steal all your shekels. But even so, I did feel pretty unsafe part of the time. I wasn't fearful of robbers, not in the least, but I am fearful of heights. Now, mind you, I'm fine with airplanes and high buildings, but don't let me walk along a path, a very narrow path, where the mountain goes 400 feet up this way and 400 feet down that way, and there's a path is covered with loose rocks and gravel, and it's probably only 18 inches wide, but it feels 3 inches wide to me. And I'm holding on to bushes for dear life, but the bushes have thorns on them. But it's better to have bloody arms than to fall to your death. And then we come to a place where there isn't even a path, just a stretch over a place where the path should be, but isn't. So yes, in my opinion, the Jericho Road is in fact still a dangerous place. Makes me think of the old gospel song, "On the Jericho Road, there's room for just two, no more and no less, just Jesus and you." Yep, that's the song I was singing on the Jericho Road. Room for just two, no more and no less, just Jesus and you.
Well, first I have to say, humility aside, that I'm pretty amazed that I walked those 100 miles in 10 days, and you could even say I'm proud of myself. I'd like to tell you about a small incident on one of our last days of trekking. This particular day had more plain old hiking and fewer stops at spots of interest. We started heading out from a dry, barren landscape with no evidence of human habitation in sight. We followed something of a trail, but not for long. There we went, like sheep, with implicit trust in our shepherd, trekking guide George, singing, "My George knows the way through the wilderness. All we have to do is follow." Up one hill to the top and down to the other side, only to be faced with a new hill with an upside and a downside all morning long. What was apparently obvious to someone like Lyndon, for me, took some effort to integrate the continuous up and down reality into my expectations. But true, the views were spectacular. I think we're behind a little bit. Yeah. I had Kent to keep me reminded of that. If he wasn't exclaiming it verbally, then he was stepping aside to snap pictures. Next one. Here I am trying to muster a pleasant facial expression. Our destination was a monastery called Mar Saba. On the previous days, we had had numerous destinations and features to break things up, but not on this day. At last, around noon, we paused on the top of a hill for a rest and a history lesson from George. From this vantage point, we could look across the valley to see a cluster of buildings clinging to the hill opposite. From a distance, it looked dollhouse-like. Hardly real. This was the monastery Mar Saba, named for the man Mar Saba, or Saint Saba. Mar Saba had in his early life spent 5 years alone in a cave not far from the spot. Eventually, followers collected and a monastery was built using architecture reminiscent of Mar Saba's childhood home in Cappadocia. We had been informed earlier that women were not permitted in the Mar Saba monastery. As I listened to the story looking across the valley, I was impressed that while women were excluded from the monastery itself, Marsaba had built two towers just outside the perimeter of the monastery where female family members could stay when they came to visit their sons or brothers. Good for you, Marsaba. And there's a, up in the left-hand corner is one of the towers, and that's where we were headed. And you can see the trail that we had to take up. Now we were ready to pick our way down the hill, steep hillside, across the stream to the other side. We're going down. As I walked along, carefully choosing my steps among the loose stones, I wasn't particularly affected one way or the other by the fact that I, as a woman, wasn't going to tour the monastery. But somewhere during the long ascent, perhaps the exertion was getting to me, I began to take on a different perspective. Hadn't I walked all those ups and downs to get there just the same as the men? Then upon arriving at one of the women's towers, I discovered that these towers looked more like prisons than any respectable accommodation. Not only that, although women weren't permitted in the monastery, many male tourists certainly felt free to go up and down the steps to the porch of the women's tower. Suddenly, this all seemed terribly unjust. In this tired state of mind, I felt insulted. Where was justice in the world? Emily and I, and the only other woman in our tour group at the time, and I rested in the shade right here till the men return. And you need to know that Lyndon and Emily's dad, Dale, managed to sneak us each a cookie from the refreshments that were offered at the end of the tour. Even while it was happening, I was surprised at my reaction to the experience. Obviously, this was a slight offense in the whole scheme of things. Many people face this kind of affront repeatedly. Palestinians, for example. One man, in whose home we stayed, told us the story of how he was turned away at an airport in Chicago. Months prior, he had gone through the tedious process of getting a visa to travel in the U.S. to visit his sister and family. At last, when he had all his paperwork in order, he bought his plane ticket and in due course arrived on U.S. soil. As expected, he was thoroughly questioned. However, the questioning went on and ended in a refusal to enter. Phone calls were made. Wilde's brother-in-law got on the phone, vouching for him, but to no avail. He was told by the official to try again in a day or two. He was not given any specific reason, just that he was not permitted to enter the USA. He returned home very discouraged and could not afford to make a second trip, nor was he inclined to ever try again. Rejection, exclusion, injustice. Kent and James also got a small taste. Jesus was born into it, which reminds me of what the prophet Micah had to say about the coming of God's messenger. Who can stand when he appears? For he will be like a refiner's fire or a launderer's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. For sure, the world is still in the refining process and still needs the proclamation of peace.
Remember how I mentioned walking among the rocks and the olive groves in the first days of the Nativity Trail? That was in the north. Closer to the Sea of Galilee, there's more rain there. In the south, around Jericho and Bethlehem, the conditions are much drier, at least at this time of year. They tell us that rains will soon be coming, but for now, we walk through hills with nothing green. No trees, no bushes, no grass. This is the domain of the Bedouin people. They seem to thrive on dry land that nobody else can make use of. They come through with their flocks of goats and sheep. These animals appear to be nibbling, grazing, eating. But what? Do these animals eat rocks? The Bedouin shepherds must know that there's a little grass here and there, even at the end of the dry season. Now, in recent years, the Bedouins have also learned how to supplement their income by offering food and lodging to travelers. The hospitality comes naturally for them. We stay at two different Bedouin camps on two successive nights. For both evenings that we spend at Bedouin camps, we are treated to music on the rababa. The best way I know how to describe the rababa is a homemade one-string violin played with a homemade bow. This is the traditional music of the Bedouin. The first evening of the rababa music, a young man performs for us. He explains that he made his own instrument with goat skin, and the goat skin must be warmed up first, so he waves it over the fire for a few minutes to warm up the rababa. Then the playing begins. He looks like he's enjoying this, and it's enjoyable to listen to. Well, it's a good thing we had the young fella play for us first. He does a good job. But the next evening at the next camp, when Khalaf, the old fella, plays the rababa, it is even better. He has a leathery face and a strong musical voice. He plays several songs, but there's a definite pattern of singing, a line or two, and then an interlude on the rababa. It's very repetitive, and the music is on and on. His songs tell old Bedouin stories about love and honor and revenge. At least that's what we're told. I'd love to be able to understand the words and get more of the details. On the trail the next day, we go right past the house, the home of Khalaf, the rababa player. He invites us in for tea, and he tries to adopt some of us into his tribe, and he almost succeeds. Chapter 10, a little town of Bethlehem today. Bethlehem doesn't look anything like the Christmas cards. It's a large town, bustling and noisy, certainly not quiet and still like in the Christmas carol. We're here at Bethlehem 6 weeks before Christmas, but already the crowds are in full force, pilgrims, tourists, and others. In the 4th century, Helena, mother of Emperor Constantine, traveled up and down this region of Palestine looking for places pertaining to Jesus. And as she identified sites, she ordered the construction of churches built right over top of the sites. So we have Helena to thank that today a humongous church stands over the site that she identified as the exact birthplace of Jesus. Entrance is by way of the door of humility, where everybody must bend to enter. This entrance had originally been a large door, but during the rule of the Turks, they had a bad habit of riding their horses right into the church just to aggravate the local people. There are no horses in the church today, but rather a long line, a huge crowd of people snaking their way through the main chapel toward the spot. Past restored mosaics, and even George's cousin, an Orthodox priest, reading the scripture. All this waiting in line in order to get a quick 10-second look at the silver star embedded in stone in the basement where the spot where Jesus was born. Hardly worth the hour and a half in line to get there. But another star over in the Catholic chapel made of stained glass is more meaningful to me. I sit and meditate on the wonder of God becoming human and being born to peasant parents who have just completed a 100-mile trek. Out of the church, we walk down the streets of Old Bethlehem. Remember our guide, George of Bethlehem. This is his town. As a guide, he was good before we were in Bethlehem, but now he is even better. He's at home. He shows us the shop his mother owns, and down the street where his father's shop and grandfather's shop used to be, and plenty of shops of his uncle's. Most of George's relatives are gone now, immigrated to places in Europe and America, like most of the Bethlehem Christians. They sold their homes and shops to others who are unable to leave, mostly from the southern city of Hebron. Living in Bethlehem today is like living in a prison, George tells us. A 20-foot-high wall was built about a decade ago to protect the settlers from the Palestinians is the official reason. But now, many farmers are separated from their farmlands. The Bethlehem farmers need permission to visit their own fields, grazing grounds, or olive groves. Even at harvest time, permission is often delayed or even denied, and there is no recourse, no place to appeal, no complaint office. The security needs of the recent settlers take priority over the needs and rights of the people who have been here for generations. George hopes to leave someday too, for the sake of his children, he says, so they can have a better life, not living in this prison that Bethlehem has become. How still we see thee lie, the Christmas carol says. Maybe, but just under the surface is a lot of suffering and injustice.
We ended our hike in Bethlehem, but then we had another couple of days in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a large city, population of about 900,000, and much of the city is modern until you go into the walls of the old city. The old city is not very big, only about a third of a square mile. On the east side of it is the Dome of the Rock. This photo is from the west side looking east across the old city. The dome is a Muslim mosque and is considered the third most holy site of the Muslim faith. Inside the mosque is the rock where it is said the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. Just on the other side of the mosque is the eastern wall of Jerusalem, and outside the wall, the land drops off sharply into the Kidron Valley, a fairly small valley. And on the other side of the Kidron Valley is the Mount of Olives. That whole higher area you see in the distance is the Mount of Olives. It's not a large mountain, really just more of a hill. The large tan area on the right of the Mount of Olives is a very large Jewish cemetery. And at the base of the Mount of Olives is a grove of olive trees. Right there. You can see the green area. In Jesus' time, that place was called in Aramaic, Gatsmani. Gatsmani means oil press. So at some point, perhaps when Jesus walked in this garden, or maybe at an earlier time, there was an olive press. There isn't one now. In Greek, Gatsami means Gethsemane, and that's what this small garden is still known as today, the Garden of Gethsemane. As I said, it's a garden of olive trees. Olive trees can grow very old, and they look old. Some say a few of these olive trees were already growing here when Jesus came to the garden, although that's not been scientifically proven. On our last morning in the Holy Lands, I went out for an early morning run because I wanted to take a photo of the old city from the top of Mount Olives at sunrise. It was a really good time of reflection as I looked down over Jerusalem and thought about all the history of my faith that was written in this ancient place. When I ran back down the mount, I passed by the Garden of Gethsemane again. That early in the morning, it was still a very quiet and peaceful place, but I thought about the Thursday night of Holy Week when Jesus took his disciples there for a quiet place to pray. One of the accounts in the Gospel of Luke reads, "Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, 'Pray that you will not fall into temptation.' He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed, 'Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done.' An angel of heaven appeared to him and strengthened him, and being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground." I could almost picture the disciples sitting under this tree and Jesus under another tree. As I ran back to the hostel where we were staying, I was thinking about all the things we had seen and learned about the current Palestinian conflict. We related to a lot of people who want peace in their land. And in the villages and countryside where we walked, we saw and experienced a great amount of peace. But it seemed that just below the surface of that peace, there's a lot of unrest and tension. And I likened that to the Garden of Gethsemane on the night when Jesus was there. It was peaceful on the surface, but for Jesus, it was anything but peaceful because he knew the road he needed to walk. I was glad I had the opportunity to walk even a small part of the Holy Lands for 2 weeks, and I came back more aware of the terribly complicated issues they're dealing with, and I hope that I can do a small part by talking about it with my friends to increase our awareness and understanding of what the people in the Holy Lands deal with every day.
Chapter 12, Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. In Old Jerusalem, is this Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest site for Christians, we are told. Helena, who founded the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem in the 4th century, also founded the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It is built over the site where Jesus died and was buried, Calvary, Golgotha, just outside the walls of Jerusalem in Jesus' day. But later a new wall was built which incorporated this site into the city, the old city, that is. Many varieties of Christians won a piece of the action at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Orthodox, Catholic, Coptic, Armenian, Ethiopian, and Syriac, to name a few. But there is just one site and one building, so they share it and sometimes squabble. But it's better now than in the past. Now they have an agreement over who gets control of what space and when, and who may open which doors or close which windows. This agreement is called the status quo. It's been in place a mere 150 years now, the status quo. And since the status quo doesn't give anyone the right to move a certain ladder on the outside of the building, it's still there 150 years later. Perhaps that's enough about the squabbling of God's children. Inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the biggest part of the crowd is waiting to see the tomb where they say Jesus was buried. The crowd is noisy and huge and moving too slowly, so we skip the tomb. Perhaps just seeing the other chapels and shrines and paintings will give me enough to meditate on. Chapter 13, the Yad Vashem Holocaust Center in Jerusalem. The Holocaust, how does one even talk about it? Yad Vashem is a very, very well done museum on the most somber of topics. I understand the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is quite impressive too. Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the Holocaust Museum, tells the stories of Jewish people in Germany, Poland, and so forth, leading to and during World War II from many different perspectives. Photographs, artifacts, displays, and short videos tell their story. After an hour and a half, I feel that my capacity to take in any more Holocaust information is about full. The emotions are spent. If this is what it means, if this is what human beings are capable of doing to other human beings, then where is the resignation table because I want to resign? A book in the bookstore at the end of the museum, written in German, is called Und Gott sah, dass es schlecht war, and God saw that it was bad. An obvious play on words from Genesis 1, where God saw in creation that it was good. Let's catch a train now and head back to the old city for our final chapter. Chapter 14, the Western Wall and Prayers for the Peace of Jerusalem and Beyond. Sorry about the numbering there, it's 14, and it's the last one. The most visited site in the whole of Israel is the Western Wall in the old city of Jerusalem. This is the same wall that is often called the Wailing Wall, but Western Wall is the term the Jewish people prefer. The Western Wall is a retaining wall of the Temple Mount and is the only visible remainder of the ancient Jewish temples. This is a favorite place for Jewish people to pray, since it is the closest spot to where the Holy of Holies once was. Tourists are allowed to go there after going through a security checkpoint. Men must have their head covered with a yarmulke, sometimes called a kippah, or any other hat or cap. Women can now approach the Western Wall in a separate women's area, and this wasn't always the case. Psalm 122, 6-9, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May those who love you be secure. May there be peace within your walls and security within your citadels. For the sake of my family and friends, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your harmony. Peace, shalom, well-being, security, prosperity, salam, living in harmony, peace. And so, with cap on head, I approach the western wall. I don't have a written prayer to wedge between the blocks like many have done. My prayer is in my heart and on my mind. For all your people, God, bring shalom, bring peace, bring well-being. Here in Jerusalem, yes. Also in Bethlehem, in Nazareth, and in Tel Aviv. Shalom to the Jews. Salam to the Palestinians. Peace to the world. Peace to the shepherds. Peace to the travelers from afar. Peace to the earth. Peace on the earth. And goodwill to all. Amen.
Good morning. I'm Roger Robertson. I was also a participant on the trek. I've never been on a trip where every day was good and special. I learned so much and it corrected so many of my misconceptions. The Palestinian people are a kind and generous people. I never felt any sense of fear. What made it special, though, were especially the participants of this adventure. Lyndon, your organization skills and leadership were paramount. It was flawless. Ruth, your gift of love and song was appreciated by all languages. Blaine, you were truly the Pied Piper for children. They appreciated your love and joy. Ray, you always carried the extra water and food, always thinking of others. James, I wish he was here. His quiet wit and thoughtfulness was appreciated. Kent, I've never seen anyone take so many pictures. You are truly blessed with your love of your wife and daughter. And Laszlo, you were truly our linguist. Your comfort with culture and your gift of languages was appreciated. Also, Lyndon wanted me to remind everybody that tomorrow evening at his home at 6:30, he will be having a showing of the pictures and a story for those who missed it. So he hopes that many people will show up at his house. Also, Nativity Trail 2019 is scheduled for October 29th to November 14th. And to talk to Lyndon if you are interested. Thank you so much.